Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CIO House View monthly live stream. Today is Thursday, October 3rd, 2024. Happy birthday to my mom. And also, I want to wish all of our friends, colleagues, and family members who are celebrating the Rosh Hashanah holiday, Shana Tova. So hopefully you're all with your friends and enjoying some time, downtime, and celebrating the holiday together. For today's live stream, I'm going to be joined by my two fantastic CIO colleagues, Leslie Falconio and Paul Shao. And as you know, we always appreciate hearing from you, our live audience. We are going to open it up to questions from all of you a little bit later in the show. So right now on the screen where you are watching this, you should see an Ask a Question button to allow you to engage. Just type it in and we'll get it here in the room on the screen that's on the floor right in front of us, giving you all the behind-the-scenes looks at how things work around here. Anyway, we'll dive into that a little bit later. But in the meantime, let's start with Paul, who's sitting next to me. Paul, first of all, welcome to the show. Good to see you.
Thank you. My first time.
Yeah, welcome. It's nice to have you. It's always nice to break people in on the live show. But I want to start with a kind of a sobering question. And we saw earlier this week that Iran launched a missile attack on Israel. It was sort of imminent. Even the White House had been telegraphing that it could potentially happen, and it did. We all watched it on television just 2 days ago. And, you know, everybody right now is waiting for the response from Israel besides defending themselves on the day of the attacks. But just looking at it with the investment lens, how should we and our viewers who are our clients and advisors be looking at this situation from an investment perspective?
Sure. Before we get to the investment lens, I just want to say that conflicts like this have a human cost that investors and markets can't fully appreciate. But if we just look at the investment lens, generally, conflicts in the Middle East tends to have a transmission mechanism into two parts. One is oil prices, and then two is volatility. And then looking at these two metrics, while both of them have risen, they look pretty contained. Oil prices, just because Iran is also one of the largest oil producers in the world, have risen to, I think, above $70 now, rising a little bit. But we're still far from the highs we saw earlier this year, which have been closer to the upper 80s. So I'd say it's rising, but still contained. Volatility has also risen in the last couple of days. But in general, volatility tends to rise before large macro events, like the election, like, you know, a rate cut, and volatility has been higher in the second half of the year than it has been during the first half of the year, where the VIX was below 15. Today, I think it touched 20. So certainly concerns are rising, but they seem to be contained. And certainly these events have justified our messages and focus, which have been seek quality growth in case of risk events happening, and also position ahead of the election, where we asked our clients before to consider hedging strategies, modest hedging strategies, as volatility tends to rise in the months leading to the election, which we've seen such at these events.
Right. As we always say, and this is a common saying, is that the markets hate uncertainty. And unfortunately, there's just all this uncertainty around us. So as we always say to our viewers, make sure you're talking with your financial advisor at UBS, because they can, as you said, tap into some of those messages and the themes that we are creating here in the CIO about preparing for volatility and uncertainty. Thank you, Paul. Leslie, I want to bring you in. First of all, thanks for joining us here today remotely. You recently discussed the tight range we're seeing in 10-year yields throughout the third quarter. And as we were just talking about here, there are a lot of risks and risk variables that continue to hit the markets. We just had Hurricane Helene, where the toll on, you know, life and property was significant. We have this heightened geopolitical risk, the strifes in the Middle East, the continuing Russia-Ukraine war that's happening, and obviously the election coming up here in the U.S. in just a couple of weeks. But the markets don't appear to be reacting to this volatility on the Treasury side. How do you see this playing out in the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Paul had mentioned, I mean, we have seen a little bit of intraday volatility. So the interest rate vol, you know, recently has been moving up. But Anthony, there's no question we've been in this 3.5% to 4% range since the beginning of August. And, you know, just to reiterate our point of view, you know, we've been leaning towards what we call a bull steepener since the start of the second half of the year, meaning that yields would come down and led by the front end coming down. And, you know, since we reached that 4.73 in April, you know, we do have 10-year Treasury yields down about 100 basis points. But since August, we've really been stuck in this range. And I think it's twofold. I mean, one is that when we talk about things like, you know, the strike, it really depends on how much this is sustained and how long this goes on for. You know, this will hit what we call more of the goods inflation side. It's really been that service side that's been a little bit stickier. But overall, when we look at the fundamentals of the economy, what we saw with, you know, the 3% in second quarter GDP, the 2.5% expected for third, and the fact that we have things like, you know, the claims number coming down, you know, the market right now is really focused on just the fundamental part, and particularly that growth in labor part. So while, you know, we've always talked about, particularly what we see from these claims number, is while we had that unemployment rate edge a little higher, this isn't really coming from layoffs. And so I think as we've shifted and had the Fed cut that 50 basis points, you know, that sort of hard landing scare has been removed from the marketplace. So we've stayed really in this range. Now, we had trimmed some of our interest rate exposure back in the beginning of August and really been more towards that neutral side. And we looked at that range, that 3.5% to 4%, really as a guide of how we want to play this going forward and into the fourth quarter. I mean, one thing I will note, because one thing we do pay attention to, and we've mentioned on, you know, on this, you know, broadcast before and in our publications, is that we do look at things like inflation expectations in the TIPS market. And, you know, we wrote about 2.5 weeks ago that when there was this more of a hard landing scenario that was sort of eking into the Treasury market when Treasury yields had really fallen, we saw inflation expectations drop quite a bit. And this is during a time when, you know, Paul mentioned, you know, oil. This is during a time when oil was just a little bit over 65.5. And inflation expectation in the 5-year had dropped to about a 1.88%, which in our opinion was quite low. One of the things recently that has changed and shifted up, you know, fairly dramatically in a short period of time has been that inflation expectation. Now we're looking at a 5-year TIPS break-even inflation expectation right now at about 212, and this was from 188 just a couple of weeks ago. Now, there's a few reasons for that. One is the fact that the hard landing scenario has been priced out a little bit, and now we're really gearing more towards that soft landing. So inflation expectations are, you know, sort of stabilizing. Second is that 50 basis point cut has those, you know, inflation vigilantes a little bit more on guard going forward, particularly since this is the start of a cutting cycle. And third, you know, as part of it has to do with the recovery in oil. So we are seeing that inflation expectation rise a little bit, but we still remain in that 3.5% to 4% range. And we do think that range will probably remain for into the fourth quarter, into the end of the year.
Great. Thanks, Leslie. And just to reiterate, and anybody who's watched our shows before knows that our view here in the Chief Investment Office from our economist, Brian Rose, is that between September's meeting that just took place a couple weeks ago and the end of 2025, we expect the Fed will take 200 basis points out and cut in as far as rates are concerned. And Leslie, just to reiterate what you were talking about, we're looking at a 10-year Treasury yield right now that's sitting at about a 3.83%. It's been slightly upticked in the last two or three sessions, but still higher than that 2-year yield, which we saw the de-inversion happen after the Fed rate cut, which we can get into in here in a little bit. But Paul, let me pivot to you, because with the Fed, obviously many of our viewers are aware that the Fed cut rates at the September meeting by 50 basis points. And we're looking at a lot of economic data that is just, you know, all over the place. First of all, we have the jobs numbers coming out tomorrow that everybody's going to be focusing on, where the consensus for non-farm payrolls is 140,000. And unemployment the unemployment rate is expected to stay steady at 4.2%. This morning, we had the ISM services come in higher than expected. It was a 20-month high. So there's such, you know, varied data that the Fed has to watch. So let's go back and give us your thoughts on what the Fed was thinking about when they cut 50 basis points in September and what they may be thinking going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a very strange cycle. I think most people would agree with that. But I think the most important question that investors have been grappling with this year is, are we in a soft landing? And what is the policy response to that? So I think it's worth putting this 50 basis points of cuts into context. Mm-hmm. At the start of the year, risk assets celebrated the fact that we had a very benign macro environment and were pricing in, I think, around 6 to 7 rate cuts. So rate cuts plus good growth expectations, good for risk assets. Towards the end of Q1, over the summertime, growth data, inflation data was still quite hot, and they were discounting rate cuts, which precipitated the sell-off, in my opinion. And then now, ahead of the 50 basis point rate cut in September, we were expecting 100 basis points of rate cuts during September all the way through December, because we thought that the cooling in the labor market data, as well as more confident disinflation trend, was enough for the Fed to cut rates 100 basis points throughout the year.
Right.
So 50 basis points, I think, is a good start to that, front-loading some of that early on. Equity markets certainly have cheered that on. But I think more importantly is the direction of travel. You've mentioned that we're expecting around 200 basis points of rate cuts this year and next year. And should that happen, I think that's a pretty benign environment for risk assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I think a lot of folks were wondering if the Fed maybe cut too much in September, although as we know now, it seemed to be the right move because there is evidence that even though jobs are, you know, the unemployment rate has ticked up a little bit higher, it's still near multi-decade lows. And so it's such an interesting place to sit. And Leslie, I guess we can continue that with you because we recently saw with the ADP report, as I mentioned earlier, we're also waiting tomorrow's non-farm payroll and unemployment rate data. The Fed has shifted its focus from price stability now to full employment. Obviously, they still have the inflation mandate, but employment is certainly a huge part of that picture. So it appears that the tone of the market is a likely soft landing outcome, and I know that's still our call here in the Chief Investment Office. 220 basis points of cuts this cycle. Is it aggressive for a soft landing scenario? And why do you think this disparity could play out between the data and what the Fed expectations are?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that the Fed is still on the debt independence mantra, right? And because they still have that as their lead, you're going to see a little bit of volatility in the short end of the curve, you know, going forward. But to that point, I think that, you know, when the Fed cut 50, you know, of course, the first expectation from the fixed income market is that 50 will be a trend, meaning that, you know, they'll go 50 and then another 50. And I think because of the, you know, data that we've seen, such as, you know, ADP or ISM or the 3% in second quarter GDP, that expectation is getting a bit priced out. I mean, for the November, now the market's only pricing in about a 30% chance of a 50 basis point cut. In December, it's still around 70, 72%. But again, I mean, tomorrow is going to be, you know, a big, it really will dictate that path. But, you know, the market has a tendency, particularly the fixed income market, to get a little bit ahead of itself in terms of, you know, the expectation of the Feds. We've seen this many times before. And right now, if I look at, say, like the December 2025, you know, futures contract or the Fed expectation, it's like a 2.8%. So it's trending towards what the Fed believed that neutral rate is. That's quite a bit of a large move, given the information that we have right now. Obviously, if sentiment should change or if the unemployment rate goes up or if we see, you know, a large amount of layoffs occurring, then that's one thing. But for now, from what we've seen, you know, that is a pretty dovish outlook by the market. So it wouldn't be surprising to us to see some of those cuts get priced out. And that's why we're really looking at that upper range of that, you know, 4% to start adding back. Because as always, you know, the fixed income market is getting a little bit too aggressive. You know, we'll see what tomorrow will dictate. And plus, you know, we won't really get some of the impact from Hurricane Helene until the next payroll report. So you will have a little bit of clouded data. But right now, it seems as though the market's got a little bit ahead of itself, given what we've seen right now.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. I want to shift focus a little bit, Paul, back to you. And let's talk about what's happening on the other side of the Pacific, because many of us know, or maybe our viewers know, that Chinese policymakers recently announced a pretty aggressive form of stimulus. Although, if you look at the Asian markets in the last session or two, Hong Kong has kind of pulled back a little bit. So maybe the initial excitement of it is waning a little bit. So that begs the question, do you expect that we might see more stimulus? Is this a one and done? Are Chinese policymakers looking at the bigger picture and figuring out what their next move is going to be?
Yeah, I think investors in Asian markets certainly cheered on the recent round of policy stimulus from the Chinese government. After, you know, several years of very little support from the government, as well as weak macro and weak risk asset scenarios. So this certainly was a plus for them. I think it was really precipitated by the weaker than expected recent data from the Chinese economy, as well as the somewhat surprised 50 basis points from the Fed showing that actually, you know, there is a global round of easing that is happening, and China shouldn't necessarily be out of the curve when it comes to these sort of things.
Right.
When it comes to the next step, I think that there is more scope for easing, but it is worth just noting that this policy announcement, while not quite a bazooka in my opinion, was pretty significant. It was coordinated across different avenues of the Chinese government, and they even pulled ahead a policy meeting in order to just craft and announce these things. I think our colleagues in the IB are calling for marginal stimulus towards the rest of the year that could come either in late October, November, when we have an NPC meeting, or in mid-December, where we have the Chinese Economic Work Conference, in the form of slightly lower rates. But certainly, it is something from the government that should be supportive for Asian investors. And the direction of travel that I mentioned, that the Fed also signaled, seemed to be, I think, playing in policymakers' minds in China as well.
Great. Paul, thank you. Before I continue on, I want to remind our viewers, if you do have a question, make sure to click the Ask a Question button on your screen, and we'll get it here in the room. You may have questions out there for Leslie and Paul, so make sure to get those in. We'll get to those in a couple minutes. I also want to say, I just got a chat from our colleague, Amantia Muhadini, and said the Fed dot plot suggests an additional 50 basis points of cuts by year end and another 100 basis points in 2025, which is in line with our base case scenario. So CIO is on the move, and we are right in line with what the Fed's dot plot is talking about. Thank you, Amantia. Okay, so Leslie, let me bring you back in. Again, with fixed income, which is, of course, your area of expertise, it has been outperforming. And when you look at U.S. Treasury showing a positive return for five consecutive months, and that's the first time since 2010, according to the data that we're looking at. And we're also seeing lower credit quality sectors outperforming. Do you think the market is overdone at these levels? And I guess the part two of that question is, where do you see the value over the remainder of 2024 into the new year?
Well, I mean, look, when we think about what's happened this just in the past several months and how loose financial conditions have become, I mean, you have the stock market making these all-time highs. I've had, you know, yields rally 100 basis points, and we've had this huge tightening in credit spreads. But I know that when we talked about sort of locking in, you know, in the beginning of the year, there was a lot of pushback because there's difficulty at that point in time in knowing where interest rates are going to go. Because if we remember, when we started the year, we had seven cuts priced in. Now, lo and behold, if we look today, I'm at a 3.83 10-year treasury yield, which is almost exactly where I was in the beginning of the year. I was at 3.85. And yet I have things such as investment-grade corporates that are up 5.5%, preferreds that are up 13%, high yield, which is up 7%. All these sectors have really performed well, not necessarily because of price appreciation, because we've had this huge decline in interest rates. Granted, the short end is down about 40, 50 basis points, bills being down the most, but the two-year yield down 40. But this is really due to spread compression and carry. So when we think about what's occurred this year, and I'm looking at yields right now at a high yield that's about a 660, right, which is much lower than where I started the year. Okay, even though, say, like the 10-year yield is almost the exact same. So when we think about how risk assets have done, given how loose financial conditions have become, they've done really well. And it's not as though we're thinking there's going to be some sort of catalyst on the horizon, but you really need to take a look at the type of relative value that you're earning, or the fact that the amount of cushion that you have in case there is some sort of a fatal event, or in case, for example, interest rates, you know, rise a bit more due to inflation or even stronger growth. You know, we've had spreads compress as yields have come down. Normally, the situation is that spreads compress when yields rise because that's an indication of stronger growth. But we've had such amount of money on the sideline and such sort of like this quest for yield, if you will, we've had these risk assets perform really well. And although we've had pushback about that locking in, it actually proved to be the right allocation, because right now these asset classes have well outperformed cash. So when we think about what we want to do going forward, we're going to stay with that higher quality. And again, not because we think there's going to be a catalyst, but just because, you know, we want to stay with that whatever incremental yield that we're getting from that treasury market that's in a higher quality, sort of safer, if you will, kind of credit spectrum to earn that carry. Now, our view of interest rates going forward, even if you look at our projection for 2025, you were looking at a 3.5% 10-year yield in June. We were just at a 3.59, right, in the beginning of September. So it's not as though we're expecting this hard landing scenario where interest rates are going to decline materially. That's not really what we're expecting at all. So the driver is not going to be from price appreciation. And because spreads are so compressed, more than likely the driver is not going to be from spread compression. It's going to be from carry. And if you want to take that carry at this stage, what we want to do, even though we do expect a soft landing, is that you want to do it in a higher quality asset. So that's really where we're positioned. The second thing I want to just know, and we've talked about this before, is that we've really pushed against going in that long end of the curve. I mean, our steepener that we've had, right, that's underperformance of the long end, whether yields go up or whether they go down, that long end is underperforming. And that is really sort of the tactical play that we still have, regardless of whether interest rates go up or down. We want to stay away from that long end. We want to stay around that 3 to 7 year to really just earn that carry, but stay in that higher quality just to protect against, you know, particular events going forward.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Leslie, a lot of that decline we saw in specifically with the 10-year Treasury yield ahead of the Fed meeting in September was the market pricing in the Fed's cut, correct? And that's why we're starting to see yields maybe balance out to where they would normally be at this level?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is, I mean, part of this started, I mean, when the Fed, really what it was when the Fed or the market, once again, from that 473 that we saw in April, was convinced that, okay, you know, you've been historically a long period of time that you've had been on pause, right? We're going back to July 2023. They became convinced that, okay, the next move will be a cut. When we had that 50 basis point move, actually the market moved, yields actually moved up. And the reason is because the, you know, Powell balanced that dovish move with what I, my opinion, is more of a hawkish rhetoric, reminding the market that while the labor market is softening, it still remains strong, reminding the market that 50 basis point is not necessarily going to be a continuous trend. And so therefore, we saw sort of this yields move higher, not to mention the fact that when we have these cuts, particularly when they're cuts from a non-recessionary kind of reaction, what happens is that that reinflation, that reacceleration of growth kind of sneaks into the marketplace until the data proves it different.
Right.
So that's really why we had that kind of backup.
Right. And I always have more follow-up questions for you, Leslie. And I have another one, which is going back to what you were talking about before with the with financial conditions loosening, and you've got, like you said, risk assets have been outperforming. Is this a risk? Have, you know, investors become maybe too complacent here?
You know, there is a level, there has been this level of complacency, because there's no question, look, the Fed is cutting, and this isn't, we're not in a recession, right? So this doesn't happen very often. So there is this complacency where the Fed will be there if, in fact, the economy should slow, because, you know, the Fed funds rate is so restrictive, it has a lot of room where it could move, and that's absolutely true. I think part of the complacency comes into play is where, especially with some of this lower quality, is that you're really not looking at that long-term relative value, whether or not you're compensated enough for it. And if you can get a very good yield and lock in that carry for higher quality assets, you know, we believe that that's what, you know, you should do. And as we talk about the path of the Fed fund rate, that yes, we might think 100 basis point cuts in 2025, but in 2024, the market's still pricing in more Fed cuts than we have in our forecast. And that'll likely be removed. But again, if tomorrow's number comes out much lower, then that's a different story. Then the sentiment will change again. I think the important part is that while the Fed remains data dependent, you're going to have this volatility a little bit in the short term, but the range more than likely for that back end is going to stay the same. But right now, we just would rather stay with that higher quality, given the fact that, you know, those with higher credit embedded sectors have really outperformed, and not because of price appreciation, because of loosening financial conditions, an outperforming equity market, and simply demanded because there was so much cash on the sideline.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. Appreciate that. Paul, let me come back to you. And this is probably on most of our viewers' minds. It's certainly on mine and everyone here, is the election coming up in just a couple of weeks, although we have seen early voting already beginning in a number of places around the country. What should clients and investors, and particularly even business owners and entrepreneurs, be thinking about when it comes to each candidate's economic plans?
Certainly. The race is very, very tight. I'd say, you know, pretty much dead heat with a slight edge towards Harris, as our Election Watch colleagues have pointed out. And there's no obvious catalyst from now until the election day. And as you noted, early voting has indeed started. I think for business owners, there is things to like for both candidates' proposals, as well as things to not like. From the Harris side, certainly I think small business owners would cheer on policy announcements such as a $50,000 tax credit, extensions to parts of the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed under the Biden administration. On the other hand, probably higher regulatory scrutiny compared to another Trump administration would be something not seen as favorable by our business owner client segment. And then on the Trump side, lower taxes likelihood, as well as less regulatory scrutiny for some industries, I think would be welcome by business owners. But the uncertainty from policies like tariffs, I think, are still a major concern. All that said, I think for our business owner clients, what's more important is really ultimately the macro conditions as well as what the Fed is doing. We know that these high restrictive, the high level of policy rates that Leslie had pointed out have really kept exits for our business owner segment quite low over the last couple of years, and that hasn't really come back. It's starting to come back a little bit. So we have lower rates from the Fed this year and next year. I think that will unlock a lot of pent-up demand and probably will have a larger effect for our business owner clients, no matter who is president.
Right. Thank you, Paul. And Leslie, you've talked about this before on other shows that we do, is that for a lot of clients who are already locked in at those higher rates, you know, you were saying right now high yield is around 6.6. I mean, some of them were locking in 7, 7.5. They're going to hold on to those as long as the duration lasts. And of course, even homeowners who have a mortgage from, you know, a few years ago that's sitting somewhere around 3.5 to 4%, they're not getting a new mortgage, obviously, because rates are higher. So there's a lot of that that's pent up in there as well. And by the way, Leslie, I'm going to sort of naturally go into the Q&A from the audience, because we did get a question for you to clarify. When you were talking about staying in that 3 to 7 year range, were you referring to maturity or were you referring to duration?
Duration.
Okay.
Yeah. So when we think about what we would call average life, right? So anywhere in that 3 to 7 year range, which actually equals that 5 year, and that's where our portfolio has been around that 5 year, that belly of the curve. But either way, you can do that as a barbell or as a bullet. But that 3 to 7 year really is where we want to stay. We really are not right now fans of that back end of the yield curve for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, given the fact that, you know, these are cuts that are not a cut due to a hard landing or recessionary environment, number one. Number two, we don't think you're going to have this really big flight to quality go into that back end. And as you know, as Anthony, if you and I talked about before, and what I'm asked constantly about is the supply picture. What's going to happen with supply, you know, going into the end of 2025, when it's projected that this supply is going to really sort of kick up again versus the stability that we've seen these past quarters. And again, things like the supply, they're not a driver of interest rate. We always call them a passenger. But either way, what that can mean, even if growth should slow and yields come down, when you have that supply, yields are going to come down by less in the back end. And if we have an environment where growth reaccelerates or inflation reaccelerates more than what we're anticipating in 2025, and you have supply, then again, you're going to have that back end underperforming, but with yields moving higher. That latter part is not our view right now, but we are cognizant of that we have more supply coming into the marketplace. But it's not going to be the driver of the direction of rates. Growth and inflation will be, but it could mitigate the amount of rally that you see, or it could expedite the backup if, in fact, growth is higher than what we're expecting.
And Leslie, quickly, does that supply, can that be impacted by the results of the election?
I think, either way, we have a large deficit. And when you think about, you know, I think there will be a knee-jerk reaction, sort of like we saw after the debate in June. You have this sort of knee-jerk reaction of a bear steepener. And both of them are not, you know, fiscally positive. And I think that when you look at the size of the deficit and the delta of what they have, it's actually very small, given the size of the deficit that we have. So I think from a knee-jerk reaction, you know, if in fact, hypothetically, we have this red sweep, there's no question you're going to have what we call a bear steepener. The sustainability of that, though, will be different. And we saw this, actually, Anthony, when you think about the debate that we had that was there in June from, you know, Trump and Biden. The next day, you had this big bear steepener, the long end backed up. You know, 2 days later, you had the employment report that was well below expectations, and it gave it all back. So the fundamentals are going to be the driver, right? Growth, inflation, monetary, all those things are going to be the driver of interest rates. The supply side, the deficit, is going to be secondary.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. Paul, I want to get to this question from the audience, and I imagined we were going to get this. And of course, we know we're looking at the dock worker strike that's taking place on the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico, and they've been striking since earlier this week. And the question is, what do you think the economic impact, it says will be, but I would say could be, because it's still early days, and there's a lot of unknown variables. What do you think the economic impact could be of that strike?
Look, obviously, it's bad for growth as well as the labor market, but this is very much a Q4 story. Most strikes historically have lasted less than 2 weeks, so it's unclear whether or not that'll have an impact toward October payrolls. But as Leslie pointed out, you know, tomorrow is an important number. Next month is probably another important number that the Fed will look at. And the longer that this strike happens, the more damaging it will be for growth as well as the labor market. But historically, in terms of These sort of exogenous shocks. The Fed tends to look past this, but it's also worth putting it into context of what the labor market is doing, because it has cooled pretty significantly over the last couple of months, too.
Right. Yeah, more to come on that. And I know that our economist, Brian Rose, whose name I dropped earlier in this program, is taking a deeper dive into the potential impact of the dock worker strike. So there may or may not be a blog or report coming out very soon from Brian. Leslie, a quick follow-up, and this also came in from our audience, is when thinking about the dock worker strike, is there any impact that you could see on projections for treasuries or anything on the fixed income side?
You know, again, it really, like I mentioned before, it really depends on the sustainability of all this. I mean, that's really the key in terms of when it, you know, seeps into the economy and how long it actually lasts for. That's the driver.
Great. Another question. Leslie, I'll give you both the opportunity to answer it. And I'll stay with us, Leslie. When should we see government money market funds drop below 5%? I mean, that's probably a hard-to-answer question, but obviously we would expect that given that the Fed is expected to continue to cut rates. Leslie, do you want to jump in on that?
Or no, yeah, Paul, I mean, I said earlier, and this is true. I mean, you've had since the beginning of the year a 10-year yield that's maybe different by 5 basis points. You've had a 2-year that's down, you know, maybe, you know, 40. But the real decline has been in that bill market, right? I mean, if I look at things like even the 6-month bill right now is like a 4.36. So I do think that, you know, as the Fed, depending on what tomorrow's number is, but I would project that it won't be very long before you really start to see a material move down in some of those money market funds. And you've seen it partly for those just in the plain bill market. And, you know, and I expect that to continue, because regardless if it's a 25 or 50 or whether the Fed is doing, you know, 50 or another 75 at the end of the year, they're cutting. And this isn't a one and done type of scenario. So with that cutting cycle, we all might have a different view of what that terminal rate might be, but the trend is still for a cut. And that trend will continue into 2025. So it won't be long before you really start to see what you already have started to see a material move in that bill market. And we've seen it already, but it's going to continue.
Great point. Thank you, Leslie. All right, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you to the audience for sending in those questions. And, of course, thank you to Paul and to Leslie, my two terrific colleagues who always give us lots to think about as we walk away from this program. And hopefully our viewers are thinking about it, to have that conversation with your financial advisor and continue it there. So again, thank you to Paul and Leslie, and thank you to all of our colleagues who help put these shows together every month. And thank you, the audience, for spending time with us. Just to keep you updated on what's going on, we've got a bunch of things happening over the next month. Perhaps you know there's an election happening on Tuesday, November 5th, if you've been paying attention. Certainly we have. So we're going to have a lot of live streams in and around the election timeframe. Particularly, we'll also have a CIO Live, that's this show, on that Thursday, November 7th at 1 p.m. So we'll be talking about whatever's happening at that moment in that election cycle. So make sure to mark your calendars for that again, Thursday, November 7th at 1 p.m. And until then, we'll continue to keep you updated with all of our latest views through the House View publications, the CIO alerts, and more. Plus, we have lots of great multimedia content available. You can check out all of our videos, like our regular UBS Trending and Road to the Election series, as well as podcasts featuring more colleagues from the UBS CIO and our best partners. And again, please make sure, if you have any questions or you just want to continue this conversation, that you are talking with your UBS financial advisor. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a wonderful weekend. And again, everybody who's celebrating the holiday, we wish you a good year. Shana Tova. Take care, everybody. See you soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.